Labor unions. Although employer organizations have sought to keep employees' pay from rising to the level it would reach by supply and demand in a free competitive market, while labor unions seek to raise wage rates above where they would be in a free competitive market, these very different intentions can lead to similar consequences in terms of the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. Legendary American labor leader John L. Lewis, head of the United Mine Workers from 1920 to 1960, was enormously successful in winning higher pay for his union's members. However, an economist also called him the world's greatest oil salesman, because the resulting higher price of coal and the disruptions in its production due to numerous strikes caused many users of coal to switch to using oil instead. This, of course, reduced employment in the coal industry. By the 1960s, declining employment in the coal industry left many mining communities economically stricken, and some became virtual ghost towns. Media stories of their plight seldom connected their current woes with the former glory days of John L. Lewis. In fairness to Lewis, he made a conscious decision that it was better to have fewer miners doing dangerous work underground and more heavy machinery down there, since machinery could not be killed by cave-ins, explosions, and the other hazards of mining. To the public at large, however, these and other trade-offs were largely unknown. Many simply cheered at what Lewis had done to improve the wages of miners, and years later were compassionate toward the decline of mining communities, but made little or no connection between the two things. Yet what was involved was one of the simplest and most basic principles of economics, that less is demanded at a higher price than at a lower price. That principle applies whether considering the price of coal, of the labor of mine workers, or anything else. Very similar trends emerged in the automobile industry, where the danger factor was not what it was in mining. Here, the United Automobile Workers Union was also very successful in getting higher pay, more job security, and more favorable work rules for its members. In the long run, however, all these additional costs raised the price of automobiles and made American cars less competitive with Japanese and other cars, not only in the United States, but in markets around the world. As of 1950, the United States produced 3/4 of all the cars in the world, and Japan produced less than 1% of what Americans produced. 20 years later, Japan was producing almost 2/3 as many automobiles as the United States, and 10 years after that, more automobiles. By 1990, 1/3 of the cars sold within the United States were Japanese. In a number of years since then, more Honda Accords or Toyota Camrys were sold in the United States than any car made by any American car company. All this, of course, had its effect on employment. By 1990, the number of jobs in the American automobile industry was 200,000 less than it had been in 1979. Political pressures on Japan to voluntarily limit its export of cars to the U.S. led to the creation of Japanese automobile manufacturing plants in the United States, hiring American workers to replace the lost exports. By the early 1990s, these transplanted Japanese factories were producing as many cars as were being exported to the United States from Japan. And by 2007, 63% of Japanese cars sold in the United States were manufactured within the United States. Many of these transplanted Japanese car companies had workforces that were non-union, and which rejected unionization when votes were taken among the employees in secret ballot elections conducted by the government. The net result, by the early 21st century, was that Detroit automakers were laying off workers by the thousands, while Toyota was hiring American workers by the thousands. The decline of unionized workers in the automobile industry was part of a more general trend among industrial workers in the United States. The United Steelworkers of America was another large and highly successful union in getting high pay and other benefits for its members. But here, too, the number of jobs in the industry declined by more than 200,000 in a decade, while the steel companies invested $35 billion in machinery that replaced these workers, and while the towns where steel production was concentrated were economically devastated. The once common belief that unions were a blessing and a necessity for workers was now increasingly mixed with skepticism and apprehension about the union's role in the economic declines and reduced employment in many industries. Faced with the prospect of seeing some employers going out of business or having to drastically reduce employment, some unions were forced into givebacks, that is, relinquishing various wages and benefits they had obtained for their members in previous years. Painful as this was, many unions concluded that it was the only way to save members' jobs. A front-page news story in the New York Times summarized the situation in the early 21st century. In reaching a settlement with General Motors on Thursday, and in recent agreements with several other industrial behemoths, Ford, Daimler Chrysler, Goodyear, and Verizon, unions have shown a new willingness to rein in their demands. Keeping their employers competitive, they have concluded, is essential to keeping unionized jobs from being lost to non-union, often lower-wage companies elsewhere in this country or overseas. Unions and their members had, over the years, learned the hard way what is usually taught early on in introductory economics courses, that people buy less at higher prices than at lower prices. It is not a complicated principle, but it often gets lost sight of in the swirl of events and the headiness of rhetoric. The proportion of the American labor force that is unionized has declined over the years, as skepticism about unions' economic effects spread among workers who have increasingly voted against being represented by unions. Unionized workers were 32% of all workers in the middle of the 20th century, but only 14% by the end of the century. Moreover, there was a major change in the composition of unionized workers. In the first half of the 20th century, the great unions in the U.S. economy were in mining, automobiles, steel, and trucking. But by the end of that century, the largest and most rapidly growing unions were those of government employees. By 2007, only 8% of private sector employees were unionized. The largest union in the country by far was the Union of Teachers, the National Education Association. The economic pressures of the marketplace, which had created such problems for unionized workers in private industry and commerce, did not apply to government workers. Government employees could continue to get pay raises, larger benefits, and job security without worrying that they were likely to suffer the fate of miners, automobile workers, and other unionized industrial workers. Those who hired government workers were not spending their own money, but the taxpayers' money, and so had little reason to resist union demands. Moreover, they seldom faced such competitive forces in the market as would force them to lose business to imports or to substitute products. Most government agencies have a monopoly of their particular function. Only the Internal Revenue Service collects taxes for the federal government, and only the Department of Motor Vehicles issues states' driver licenses. In private industry, many companies have remained non-union by a policy of paying their workers at least as much as unionized workers received. Such a policy implies that the cost to an employer of having a union exceeds the wages and benefits paid to workers. The hidden costs of union rules on seniority and many other details of operations are, for some companies, worth being rid of for the sake of greater efficiency, even if that means paying their employees more than they would have to pay to unionized workers. The unionized Big Three American automobile makers, for example, have required from 26 hours to 31 hours of labor per car, while the largely non-unionized Japanese automakers required from 17 to 22 hours. Western European labor unions have been especially powerful, and the many benefits that they have gotten for their members have had their repercussions on the employment of workers and the growth rates of whole economies. Western European countries have for years lagged behind the United States, both in economic growth and in the creation of jobs. A belated recognition of such facts led some European unions and European governments to relax some of their demands and restrictions on employers in the wake of an economic slump. In 2006, the Wall Street Journal reported, "Europe's economic slump has given companies new muscle in their negotiations with workers. Governments in Europe have been slow to overhaul worker-friendly labor laws for fear of incurring voters' wrath. That slowed job growth as companies transferred operations overseas where labor costs were lower. High unemployment in Europe depressed consumer spending, helping limit economic growth in the past 5 years to a meager 1.4% average in the 12 countries that use the euro." In the wake of a relaxation of labor union and government restrictions in the labor market, the growth rate in these countries rose from 1.4% to 2.2%, and the unemployment rate fell from 9.3% to 8.3%. Neither of these statistics was as good as those in the United States at the time, but they were an improvement over what existed under previous policies and practices in the European Union countries. Exploitation. Usually, those who decry exploitation make no serious attempt to define it, so the word is often used simply to condemn either prices that are higher than the observer would like to see, or wages lower than the observer would like to see. There would be no basis for objecting to this word if it were understood by all that it is simply a statement about someone's internal emotional reactions, rather than being presented as a statement about some fact in the external world. We have seen in Chapter 4 how higher prices charged by stores in low-income neighborhoods have been called exploitation, when in fact there are many economic factors which account for these higher prices, often charged by local stores that are struggling to survive, rather than stores making unusually high profits. Similarly, we have seen in Chapter 10 some of the factors behind low pay for third-world workers, whom many regard as being exploited because they are not paid what workers in more prosperous countries are paid. The general idea behind exploitation theories is that some people are somehow able to receive more than enough money to compensate for their contributions to the production and distribution of output by either charging more than is necessary to consumers or paying less than is necessary to employees. In some circumstances, this is in fact possible, but we need to examine those circumstances and to see when such circumstances exist or do not exist in the real world. As we have seen in earlier chapters, earning a rate of return on investment that is greater than what is required to compensate people for their risks and contributions to output is virtually guaranteed to attract other people who wish to share in this bounty by either investing in existing firms or setting up their own new firms. This, in turn, virtually guarantees that the above-average rate of return will be driven back down by the increased competition caused by expanded investment and production, whether by existing firms or by new firms. Only where there is some way to prevent this new competition can the above-average earnings on investment persist. Governments are among the most common and most effective barriers to the entry of new competition. During the Second World War, the British colonial government in West Africa imposed a wide range of wartime controls over production and trade, as also happened within Britain itself. This was the result, as reported by an economist on the scene in West Africa. During the period of trade controls, profits were much larger than were necessary to secure the services of the traders. Over this period of great prosperity, the effective bar to the entry of new firms reserved the very large profits for those already in the trade. This was not peculiar to Africa or to the British colonial government there. The Civil Aeronautics Board and the Interstate Commerce Commission in the United States have been among the many government agencies at both the national and local levels which have restricted the number of firms or individuals allowed to enter various occupations and industries. In fact, governments around the world have at various times and places restricted how many people and which people would be allowed to engage in particular occupations or to establish firms in particular industries. This was even more common in past centuries, when kings often conferred monopoly rights on particular individuals or enterprises to engage in the production of salt or wine or many other commodities, sometimes as a matter of generosity to royal favorites, and often because the right to a monopoly was purchased for cash. The purpose or the net effect of barriers to entry has been a persistence of a level of earnings higher than that which would exist under free market competition, and higher than necessary to attract the resources required. This could legitimately be considered exploitation of the consumers, since it is a payment over and beyond what is necessary to cause people to supply the product or service in question. However, higher earnings than would exist under free market competition do not always or necessarily mean that these earnings are higher than earnings in competitive industries. Sometimes inefficient firms are able to survive under government protection when such firms would not survive in the competition of a free market. Therefore, even modest rates of return received by such inefficient firms still represent consumers being forced to pay more money than necessary in a free market, where more efficient firms would produce a larger share of the industry's output, while driving the less efficient firms out of business by offering lower prices. While such situations could legitimately be called exploitation, defined as prices higher than necessary to supply the goods or services in question, these are not usually the kinds of situations which provoke that label. It would also be legitimate to describe as exploitation a situation where people are paid less for their work than they would receive in a free market, or less than the amount necessary to attract a continuing supply of people with their levels of skills, experience, and talents. However, such situations are far more likely to involve people with high skills and high incomes than people with low skills and low incomes. Where exploitation is defined as the difference between the wealth that an individual creates and the amount that individual is paid, then Babe Ruth may well have been the most exploited individual of all time. Not only was Yankee Stadium the house that Ruth built, the whole Yankee dynasty was built on the exploits of Babe Ruth. Before he joined the team, the New York Yankees had never won a pennant, much less a World Series, and they had no ballpark of their own, playing their games in the New York Giants ballpark when the Giants were on the road. Ruth's exploits drew huge crowds, and the huge gate receipts provided the financial foundation on which the Yankees built teams that dominated baseball for decades. Ruth's top salary of $80,000 a year, even at 1932 prices, did not begin to cover the financial difference that he made to the team. But the exclusive, career-long contracts of that era meant that the Yankees did not have to bid for Babe Ruth's services against the other teams who would have paid handsomely to have him in their lineups. Here, as elsewhere, the prevention of competition is essential to exploitation. It is also worth noting that, while the Yankees could exploit Babe Ruth, they could not exploit the unskilled workers who swept the floors in Yankee Stadium, because these workers could have gotten jobs sweeping floors in innumerable offices, factories, or homes, so there was no way for them to be paid less than comparable workers received elsewhere. In some situations, people in a given occupation may be paid less currently than the rate of pay necessary to continue to attract a sufficient supply of qualified people to that occupation. Doctors, for example, have already invested huge sums of money in getting an education in expensive medical schools. In addition to an investment in the form of foregone earnings during several years of college and medical school, followed by low pay as interns before finally becoming fully qualified to conduct their own independent medical practice. Under a government-run medical system, the government can at any given time set medical salary scales, or pay scales for particular medical treatments, which are not sufficient to continue to attract as many people of the same qualifications into the medical profession in the future. In the meantime, however, existing doctors have little choice but to accept what the government authorizes, if the government either pays all medical bills or hires all doctors. Seldom will there be alternative professions which existing doctors can enter to earn better pay, because becoming a lawyer or an engineer would require yet another costly investment in education and training. Therefore, most doctors seldom have realistic alternatives available and are unlikely to become truck drivers or carpenters, just because they would not have gone into the medical profession if they had known in advance what the actual level of compensation would turn out to be. Low-paid workers can also be exploited in circumstances where they are unable to move, or where the cost of moving would be high, whether because of transportation costs or because they live in government-subsidized housing that they would lose if they moved somewhere else, where they would have to pay market prices for a home or an apartment, at least while being on waiting lists for government-subsidized housing at their new location. In centuries past, slaves could, of course, be exploited because they were held by force. Indentured servants or contract laborers, especially those working overseas, likewise had high costs of moving, and so could be exploited in the short run. However, many very low-paid contract workers chose to sign up for another period of work at jobs whose pay and working conditions they already knew about from personal experience, clearly indicating that, however low their pay and however bad their working conditions, these were sufficient to attract them into this occupation. Here the explanation was less likely to be exploitation than a lack of better alternatives, or the skills to qualify for better alternatives. Where there is only one employer for a particular kind of labor, then of course that employer can set pay scales which are lower than what is required to attract new people into that occupation. But this is more likely to happen to highly specialized and skilled people, such as astronauts, rather than to unskilled workers, whose unskilled workers are employed by a wide variety of businesses, government agencies, and even private individuals. In the era before modern transportation was widespread, local labor markets might be isolated, and a given employer might be the only employer available for many local people in particular occupations. But the spread of low-cost transportation has made such situations much rarer than in the past. Once we see that barriers to entry or exit, the latter absolute in the case of slaves, or expensive in the case of exit for doctors or for people living in local subsidized housing, for example, are key, then the term exploitation often legitimately applies to people very different from those to whom this term is usually applied. It would also apply to businesses which have invested large amounts of fixed and hard-to-remove capital at a particular location. A company that builds a hydroelectric dam, for example, cannot move that dam elsewhere if the local government doubles or triples its tax rates or requires the company to pay much higher wage rates to its workers than similar workers receive elsewhere in a free market. In the long run, however, fewer businesses tend to invest in places where the political climate produces such results, the exit of many businesses from California being a striking example. But those who have already invested in such places have little recourse but to accept a lower rate of return there. Whether the term exploitation applies or does not apply to a particular situation is not simply a matter of semantics. Different consequences follow when policies are based on a belief that is false instead of beliefs that are true. Imposing price controls to prevent consumers from being exploited or minimum wage laws to prevent workers from being exploited can make matters worse for consumers or workers if, in fact, neither is being exploited, as already shown in chapters 3 and 11. Where a given employer or a small set of employers operating in collusion constitute a local cartel in hiring certain kinds of workers, then that cartel can pay lower salaries. And in these circumstances, a government-imposed increase in salary may, within limits, not result in workers losing their jobs, as would tend to happen with an imposed minimum wage in what would otherwise be a competitive market. But such situations are very rare, and such employer cartels are hard to maintain, as indicated by the collapsing employer cartels in the postbellum South and in 19th century California. The tendency to regard low-paid workers as exploited is understandable as a desire to seek a remedy in moral or political crusades to right a wrong. But, as noted economist Henry Hazlitt said years ago, the real problem of poverty is not a problem of distribution, but of production. The poor are poor not because something is being withheld from them, but because, for whatever reason, they are not producing enough. This does not make poverty any less of a problem, but it makes a solution more difficult, less certain, and more time-consuming, as well as requiring the cooperation of those in poverty, in addition to others who may wish to help them, but who cannot solve the problem without such cooperation. The poor themselves may not be to blame, because their poverty may be due to many factors beyond their control, including the past, which is beyond anyone's control today. Some of those circumstances will be dealt with in Chapter 23. Job security. Virtually every modern industrial nation has faced issues of job security, whether they have faced these issues realistically or unrealistically, successfully or unsuccessfully. In some countries, France, Germany, India, and South Africa, for example, job security laws make it difficult and costly for a private employer to fire anyone. Labor unions try to have job security policies in many industries and in many countries around the world. Teachers' unions in the United States are so successful at this that it can easily cost a school district tens of thousands of dollars, or more than $100,000 in some places, to fire just one teacher, even if that teacher is grossly incompetent. The obvious purpose of job security laws is to reduce unemployment, but that is very different from saying that this is the actual effect of such laws. Countries with strong job security laws typically do not have lower unemployment rates, but instead have higher unemployment rates than countries without widespread job protection laws. In France, which has some of Europe's strongest job security laws, double-digit unemployment rates are not uncommon. But in the United States, Americans become alarmed when the unemployment rate approaches such a level. In South Africa, the government itself has admitted that its rigid job protection laws have had unintended consequences, among them an unemployment rate that has remained around 25% for years, peaking at 31% in 2002. As the British magazine The Economist put it, firing is such a costly headache that many prefer not to hire in the first place. This consequence is by no means unique to South Africa. The very thing that makes a modern industrial society so efficient and so effective in raising living standards, the constant quest for newer and better ways of getting work done and more goods produced, makes it impossible to keep on having the same workers doing the same jobs in the same way. For example, back at the beginning of the 20th century, the United States had about 10 million farmers and farm laborers to feed a population of 76 million people. By the end of the 20th century, there were fewer than one-fifth this many farmers and farm laborers, feeding a population more than three times as large. Yet, far from having less food, Americans' biggest problems now included obesity and trying to find export markets for their surplus agricultural produce. All this was made possible because farming became a radically different enterprise, using machinery, chemicals, and methods unheard of when the century began, and requiring the labor of far fewer people. There were no job security laws to keep workers in agriculture, where they were now superfluous, so they went by the millions into industry, where they added greatly to the national output. Farming is, of course, not the only sector of the economy to be revolutionized during the 20th century. Whole new industries sprang up, such as aviation and computers, and even old industries like retailing have seen radical changes in which companies and which business methods have survived. More than 17 million workers in the United States lost their jobs between 1990 and 1995, but there were never 17 million Americans unemployed at any given time during that period, nor anything close to that. In fact, the unemployment rate in the United States fell to its lowest point in years during the 1990s. Americans were moving from one job to another, rather than relying on job security in one place. The average American has 9 jobs between the ages of 18 and 34. In Europe, where job security laws and practices are much stronger than in the United States, jobs have in fact been harder to come by. During the decade of the 1990s, the United States created jobs at triple the rate of industrial nations in Europe. In the private sector, Europe actually lost jobs, and only its increased government employment led to any net gain at all. This should not be surprising. Job security laws make it more expensive to hire workers, and, like anything else that is made more expensive, labor is less in demand at a higher price than at a lower price. Job security policies save the jobs of existing workers, but at the cost of reducing the flexibility and efficiency of the economy as a whole, thereby inhibiting production of the wealth needed for the creation of new jobs for other workers. Because job security laws make it risky for private enterprises to hire new workers, during periods of rising demand for their products, existing employees may be worked overtime instead, or capital may be substituted for labor, such as using huge buses instead of hiring more drivers for more regular-sized buses. However it is done, increased substitution of capital for labor leaves other workers unemployed. For the working population as a whole, there may be no net increase in job security, but instead a concentration of the insecurity on those who happen to be on the outside looking in, especially younger workers entering the labor force, or women seeking to re-enter the labor force after taking time out to raise children. The connection between job security laws and unemployment has been understood by some officials, but apparently not by much of the public, including the educated public. When France tried to deal with its high youth unemployment rate of 23% by easing its stringent job security laws for people on their first job, students at the Sorbonne and other French universities rioted in Paris and other cities across the country in 2006. Occupational licensing. Job security laws and minimum wage laws are just some of the ways in which government intervention in labor markets makes those markets differ from what they would be under free competition. Among the other ways that government intervention changes labor markets are laws requiring a government-issued license to engage in some occupations. One cannot be a physician or an attorney without a license, for the obvious reason that people without the requisite training and skill would be perpetrating a dangerous fraud if they sought to practice in these professions. However, once the government has a rationale for exercising a particular power, that power can be extended to other circumstances far removed from that rationale. That has long been the history of occupational licensing. Although economists often proceed by first explaining how a free competitive market operates, and then move on to show how various infringements on that kind of market affect economic outcomes, what happened in history is that controlled markets preceded free markets by centuries. Requirements for government permission to engage in various occupations were common centuries ago. The rise of free markets was aided by the rise and spread of classical economics in the 19th century. Although both product markets and labor markets became freer in the 19th century, the forces that sought protection from competition were never completely eradicated. Gradually, over the years, more occupations began to require licenses, a process accelerated in bad economic times, such as the Great Depression of the 1930s, or after government intervention in the economy began to become more accepted again. Although the rationale for requiring licenses in particular occupations has usually been to protect the public from various risks created by unqualified or unscrupulous practitioners, the demand for such protection has seldom come from the public. Almost invariably, the demand for requiring a license has come from existing practitioners in the particular occupation. That the real goal is to protect themselves from competition is suggested by the fact that it is common for occupational licensing legislation to exempt existing practitioners, who are automatically licensed, as if it can be assumed that the public requires no protection from incompetent or dishonest practitioners already in the occupation. Occupational licensing can take many forms. In some cases, the license is automatically issued to all the applicants who can demonstrate competence in the particular occupation, with perhaps an additional requirement of a clean record as a law-abiding citizen. In other cases, there is a numerical limit placed on the number of licenses to be issued, regardless of how many qualified applicants there are. A common example of the latter is a license to drive a taxi. New York City, for example, has been limiting the number of taxi licenses since 1937, when it began issuing special medallions authorizing each taxi to operate. The resulting artificial scarcity of taxis has had many repercussions, the most obvious of which has been a rising cost of taxi medallions, which first sold for $10 in 1937, rising to $80,000 in the 1980s, and selling for more than $1 million in 2011. Part 4. Time and Risk. Chapter 13. Investment. A tourist in New York's Greenwich Village decided to have his portrait sketched by a sidewalk artist. He received a very fine sketch, for which he was charged $100. "That's expensive," he said to the artist, "but I'll pay it because it is a great sketch. But really, it took you only 5 minutes."
20 years and 5 minutes, the artist replied. Artistic ability is only one of many things which are accumulated over time for use later on. Some people may think of investment as simply a transaction with money, but more broadly and more fundamentally, it is the sacrificing of real things today in order to have more real things in the future. In the case of the Greenwich Village artist, it was time that was invested for 2 decades in order to develop the skills that allowing a striking sketch to be made in 5 minutes. For society as a whole, investment is more likely to take the form of foregoing the production of some consumer goods today, so that the labor and capital that would have been used to produce those consumer goods will be used instead to produce machinery and factories that will cause future production to be greater than it would be otherwise. The accompanying financial transactions may be what the attention of individual investors are focused on, but here, as elsewhere, for society as a whole, money is just an artificial device to facilitate real things that constitute real wealth. Because the future cannot be known in advance, investments necessarily involve risks, as well as the tangible things that are invested. These risks must be compensated if investments are to continue. The cost of keeping people alive while waiting for their artistic talent to develop, their oil explorations to finally find places where oil wells can be drilled, or their academic credits to eventually add up to enough to earn their degrees, are all investments that must be repaid if such investments are to continue to be made. The repaying of investments is not a matter of morality, but of economics. If the return on the investment is not enough to make it worthwhile, fewer people will make that particular investment in the future, and future consumers will therefore be denied the use of the goods and services that would otherwise have been produced. No one is under any obligation to make all investments pay off, but how many need to pay off, and to what extent, is determined by how many consumers value the benefits of other people's investments, and to what extent. Where the consumers do not value what is being produced, the investment should not pay off. When people insist on specializing in a field for which there is little demand, their investment has been a waste of scarce resources that could have produced something else that others wanted. The low pay and sparse employment opportunities in that field are a compelling signal to them, and to others coming after them, to stop making such investments. The principles of investment are involved in activities that do not pass through the marketplace and are not normally thought of as economic. Putting things away after you use them is an investment of time in the present to reduce the time required to find them in the future. Explaining yourself to others can be a time-consuming and even unpleasant activity, but it is engaged in as an investment to prevent greater unhappiness in the future from avoidable misunderstandings. Kinds of investments. Investments take many forms, whether the investment is in human beings, steel mills, or transmission lines for electricity. Risk is an inseparable part of these investments and others. Among the ways of dealing with risk are speculation, insurance, and the issuance of stocks and bonds. Human capital. While human capital can take many forms, there is a tendency of some to equate it with formal education. However, not only may many other valuable forms of human capital be overlooked this way, the value of formal schooling may be exaggerated and its counterproductive consequences in some cases not understood. The Industrial Revolution was not created by highly educated people, but by people with practical industrial experience. The airplane was invented by a couple of bicycle mechanics who had never gone to college. Electricity and many inventions run by electricity became central parts of the modern world because of a man with only 3 months of formal schooling, Thomas Edison. Yet all these people had enormously valuable knowledge and insights, human capital, acquired from experience rather than in classrooms. Education has, of course, also made major contributions to economic development and rising standards of living, but this is not to say that all kinds of education have. From an economic standpoint, some education has great value, some has no value, and some can even have a negative value. While it is easy to understand the great value of specific skills in medical science or engineering, for example, or the more general foundation for a number of professions provided by mathematics, other subjects, such as literature, make no pretense of producing marketable skills, but are available for whatever they may contribute in other ways. In a country where education or higher levels of education are new or rare, those who have obtained diplomas or degrees may feel that many kinds of work are now beneath them. In such societies, even engineers may prefer sitting at a desk to standing in the mud and hip boots at a construction site. Depending on what they have studied, the newly educated may have higher levels of expectations than they have higher levels of ability to create the wealth from which their expectations can be met. In the third world especially, those who are the first members of their families to reach higher education typically do not study difficult and demanding subjects like science, medicine, or engineering, but instead tend toward easier and fuzzier subjects which provide them with little in the way of marketable skills, which is to say skills that can create prosperity for themselves or their country. Large numbers of young people with schooling but without economically meaningful skills have produced much unemployment in third world nations. Since the marketplace has little to offer such people that would be commensurate with their expectations, governments have created swollen bureaucracies to hire them in order to neutralize their potential for political disaffection, civil unrest, or insurrection. In turn, these bureaucracies and the voluminous and time-consuming red tape they generate can become obstacles to others who do have the skills and entrepreneurship needed to contribute to the country's economic advancement. In India, for example, two of its leading entrepreneurial families, the Tatas and the Birlas, have been repeatedly frustrated in their efforts to obtain the necessary government permission to expand their enterprises. The Tatas made 119 proposals between 1960 and 1989 to start new businesses or expand old ones, and all of them ended in the wastebaskets of the bureaucrats. Aditya Birla, the young and dynamic inheritor of the Birla Empire, who had trained at MIT, was so disillusioned with Indian policy that he decided to expand Birla enterprises outside India and eventually set up dynamic companies in Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, and the Philippines, away from the hostile atmosphere of his home. The vast array of government rules in India, micromanaging businesses, ensured that every businessman would break some law or the other every month, according to an Indian executive. Large businesses in India set up their own bureaucracies in Delhi, parallel to those of the government, in order to try to keep track of the progress of their applications for the innumerable government permissions required to do things that businesses do on their own in free market economies, and to pay bribes as necessary to secure these permissions. The consequences of suffocating bureaucratic controls in India have been shown not only by such experiences while they were in full force, but also by the country's dramatic economic improvements after many of these controls were relaxed or eliminated. The Indian economy's growth rate increased dramatically after reforms in 1991 freed many of its entrepreneurs from some of the worst controls, and foreign investment in India rose from $150 million to $3 billion, in other words, by 20 times. Hostility to entrepreneurial minorities like the Chinese in Southeast Asia or the Lebanese in West Africa has been especially fierce among the newly educated indigenous people, who see their own diplomas and degrees bringing them much less economic reward than the earnings of minority business owners who may have less formal schooling than themselves. In short, more schooling is not automatically more human capital. It can, in some cases, reduce the country's ability to use the human capital that it already possesses. Moreover, to the extent that some social groups specialize in different kinds of education, or have different levels of performance as students, or attend educational institutions of differing quality, the same number of years of schooling does not mean the same education in any economically meaningful sense. Such qualitative differences have, in fact, been common in countries around the world, whether comparing the Chinese and the Malays in Malaysia, Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jews in Israel, Tamils and Sinhalese in Sri Lanka, or comparing various ethnic groups with one another in the United States. Financial investments. When millions of people invest money, what they are doing more fundamentally is foregoing the use of current goods and services, which they have the money to buy, in hopes that they will receive back more money in the future, which is to say that they may be able to receive a larger quantity of goods and services in the future. From the standpoint of the economy as a whole, investments mean that many resources that would otherwise have gone into producing current consumer goods, like clothing, furniture, or pizzas, will instead go into producing factories, ships, or hydroelectric dams that will provide future goods and services. Money totals give us some idea of the magnitude of investments, but the investments themselves are ultimately additions to the real capital of the country, whether physical capital or human capital. Investments may be made directly by individuals who buy corporate stock, for example, supplying corporations with money now in exchange for a share of the additional future value that these corporations are expected to add by using the money productively. Much investment, however, is by institutions such as banks, insurance companies, and pension funds. Financial institutions around the world owned a total of $60 trillion in investments in 2009, of which American institutions owned 45%. The staggering sums of money owned by various investment institutions are often a result of aggregating individually modest sums of money from millions of people, such as stockholders in giant corporations, depositors in savings banks, or workers who pay modest but regular amounts into pension funds. What this means is that vastly larger numbers of people are owners of giant corporations than those who are direct individual purchasers of corporate stock, as distinguished from those whose money makes its way into corporations through some financial intermediary. By the late 20th century, just over half the American population owned stock, either directly or through their pension funds, bank accounts, or other financial intermediaries. Financial institutions allow vast numbers of individuals, who cannot possibly all know each other personally, to nevertheless use one another's money by going through some intermediary institution which assumes the responsibility of assessing risks, taking precautions to reduce those risks, and making transfers through loans to individuals or institutions, or by making investments in businesses, real estate, or other ventures. Financial intermediaries not only allow the pooling of money from innumerable individuals to finance huge economic undertakings by businesses, they also allow individuals to redistribute their own individual consumption over time. Borrowers, in effect, draw on future income to pay for current purchases, paying interest for the convenience. Conversely, savers postpone purchases till a later time, receiving interest for the delay. Everything depends on the changing circumstances of each individual's life, with many, if not most people, being both debtors and creditors at different stages of their lives. People who are middle-aged, for example, tend to save more than young people, not only because their incomes are higher, but also because of a need to prepare financially for retirement in the years ahead, and for the higher medical expenses that old age can be expected to bring. In the United States, Canada, Britain, Italy, and Japan, the highest rates of saving have been in the 55 to 59-year-old bracket, and the lowest in the under 30-year-old bracket, the whole under 30 cohort having zero net savings in Canada and negative net savings in the United States. While those who are saving may not think of themselves as creditors, the money that they put into banks is then lent out by those banks, acting as intermediaries between those who are saving and those who are borrowing. What makes such activities something more than matters of personal finance is that these financial transactions are for the economy as a whole another way of allocating scarce resources which have alternative uses, allocating them over time, as well as among individuals and enterprises at a given time. To build a factory, a railroad, or a hydroelectric dam requires that labor, natural resources, and other factors of production that would otherwise go into producing consumer goods in the present be diverted to creating something that may take years before it begins to produce any output that can be used in the future. In short, from the standpoint of society as a whole, present goods and services are sacrificed for the sake of future goods and services. Only where those future goods and services are more valuable than the present goods and services that are being sacrificed will financial institutions be able to receive a rate of return on their investments that will allow them to offer a high enough rate of return to innumerable individuals to induce those individuals to sacrifice their current consumption by supplying the savings required. With financial intermediaries, as with other economic institutions, nothing shows their function more clearly than seeing what happens when they are not able to function. A society without well-functioning financial institutions has fewer opportunities to generate greater wealth over time. Poor countries may remain poor, despite having an abundance of natural resources, when they have not yet developed the complex financial institutions required to mobilize the scattered savings of innumerable individuals, so as to be able to make the large investments required to turn natural resources into usable output. Sometimes, foreign investors from countries which do have such institutions are the only ones able to come in to perform this function. At other times, however, there is not the legal framework of dependable laws and secure property rights required for either domestic or foreign investors to function. Financial institutions not only transfer resources from one set of consumers to another and transfer resources from one use to another, they also create wealth by joining the entrepreneurial talents of people who lack money to the savings of many others in order to finance new firms and new industries. Many, if not most, great American industries and individual fortunes began with entrepreneurs who had very limited financial resources at the outset. The Hewlett-Packard Corporation, for example, began as a business in a garage rented with borrowed money, and many other famous entrepreneurs, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, and Andrew Carnegie, for example, had similarly modest beginnings. That these individuals and the enterprises they founded later became wealthy was an incidental byproduct of the fact that they created vast amounts of wealth for the country as a whole. But the ability of poorer societies to follow similar paths is thwarted when they lack the financial institutions to allocate resources to those with great entrepreneurial ability, but little or no money. Such institutions took centuries to develop in the West. 19th century London was the greatest financial capital in the world, but there were earlier centuries when the British were so little versed in the complexities of finance that they were dependent on foreigners to run their financial institutions, notably Lombards and Jews. That is why there is a Lombard Street in London's financial district today, and another street there named Old Jewry. Not only some third world countries, but also some countries in the former communist bloc of nations in Eastern Europe have yet to develop the kinds of sophisticated financial institutions which promote economic development. They may now have capitalism, but they have not yet developed the financial institutions that would mobilize capital on a scale found in Western European countries and their overseas offshoots, such as the United States. It is not that the wealth is not there in less developed economies. The problem is that their wealth cannot be collected from innumerable small sources, concentrated, and then allocated in large amounts to particular entrepreneurs, without financial institutions equal to the complex task of evaluating risks, markets, and rates of return. In recent years, American banks and banks from Western Europe have gone into Eastern Europe to fill the vacuum. As of 2005, 70% of the assets in Poland's banking system were controlled by foreign banks, as were more than 80% of the banking assets in Bulgaria. Still, these countries lagged behind other Western nations in the use of such things as credit cards or even bank accounts. Only 1/3 of Poles had a bank account, and only 2% of purchases in Poland were made with credit cards. The complexity of financial institutions means that relatively few people are likely to understand them, which makes them vulnerable politically to critics who can depict their activities as sinister. Where those who have the expertise to operate such institutions are either foreigners or domestic minorities, they are especially vulnerable. Moneylenders have seldom been popular, and terms like Shylock or even speculator are not terms of endearment. Many unthinking people in many countries and many periods of history have regarded financial activities as not really contributing anything to the economy, and have regarded the people who engage in such financial activities as mere parasites. This was especially so at a time when most people engaged in hard physical labor in agriculture or industry, and were both suspicious and resentful of people who simply sat around handling pieces of paper while producing nothing that could be seen or felt. Centuries-old hostilities have arisen and have been acted upon against minority groups who played such roles, whether they were Jews in Europe, overseas Chinese minorities in Southeast Asia, or Chettiars in their native India or in Burma, East Africa, or Fiji. Often such groups have been expelled or harassed into leaving the country, sometimes by mob violence, because of popular beliefs that they were parasitic. Those with such misconceptions have then often been surprised to discover economic activity and the standard of living declining in the wake of their departure. An understanding of basic economics could have prevented many human tragedies, as well as many economic inefficiencies. Returns on investment. Delayed rewards for costs incurred earlier are a return on investment, whether these rewards take the form of dividends paid on corporate stock or increases in incomes resulting from having gone to college or medical school. One of the largest investments in many people's lives consists of the time and energy expended over a period of years in raising their children. At one time, the return on that investment included having the children take care of the parents in old age. But today, the return on this investment often consists only of the parents' satisfaction in seeing their children's well-being and progress. From the standpoint of society as a whole, each generation that makes this investment in its offspring is repaying the investment that was made by the previous generation in raising those who are parents today. Unearned income. Although making investments and receiving the delayed return on those investments takes many forms and has been going on all over the world throughout the history of the human race, misunderstandings of this process have also been long-standing and widespread. Sometimes these delayed benefits are called unearned income, simply because they do not represent rewards for contributions made during the current time period. Investments that build a factory may not be repaid until years later, after workers and managers have been hired and products manufactured and sold. During the particular year when dividends finally begin to be paid, investors may not have contributed anything, but this does not mean that the reward they receive is unearned, simply because it was not earned by an investment made during that particular year. What can be seen physically is always more vivid than what cannot be seen. To those who watch a factory in operation, can see the workers creating a product before their eyes. They cannot see the investment which made that factory possible in the first place. Risks are invisible, even when they are present risks, and the past risks surrounding the initial creation of the business are readily forgotten by observers who see only a successful enterprise after the fact. Also easily overlooked are the many management decisions that had to be made in determining where to locate, what kind of equipment to acquire, and what policies to follow in dealing with suppliers, consumers, and employees, any one of which decisions could spell the difference between success and failure. And, of course, what also cannot be seen are all the similar businesses that went out of business because they did not do all the things done by the surviving business we see before our eyes, or did not do them equally well. It is easy to regard the visible factors as the sole or most important factors, even when other businesses with those same visible factors went bankrupt, while an expertly managed enterprise in the same industry flourished and grew. Nor are such misunderstandings inconsequential, either economically or politically. Many laws and government economic policies have been based on these misunderstandings. Elaborate ideologies and mass movements have also been based on the notion that only the workers really create wealth, while others merely skim off profits, without having contributed anything to producing the wealth in which they unjustly share. Such misconceptions have had fateful consequences for moneylenders around the world. For many centuries, moneylenders have been widely condemned in many cultures for receiving back more money than they lent, that is, for getting an unearned income, for waiting for payment, and for taking risks. Often, the social stigma attached to moneylending has been so great that only minorities who lived outside the existing social system anyway have been willing to take on such stigmatized activities. Thus, for centuries, Jews predominated in such occupations in Europe, as the Chinese did in Southeast Asia, the Chetiers and Marwaris in India, and other minority groups in other parts of the world. Misconceptions about moneylending often take the form of laws, attempting to help borrowers by giving them more leeway in repaying loans. But anything that makes it difficult to collect a debt when it is due makes it less likely that loans will be made in the first place, or will be made at the lower interest rates that would prevail in the absence of such debtor protection policies by governments. In some societies, people are not expected to charge interest on loans to relatives or fellow members of the local community, nor to be insistent on prompt payment according to the letter of the loan agreement. These kinds of preconditions discourage loans from being made in the first place, and sometimes they discourage individuals from letting it be known that they have enough money to be able to lend. In societies where such social pressures are particularly strong, incentives for acquiring wealth are reduced. This is not only a loss to the individual who might otherwise have made wealth by going all out, it is a loss to the whole society when people who are capable of producing things that many others are willing to pay for may not choose to go all out in doing so. Investment and allocation. Interest, as the price paid for investment funds, plays the same allocational role as other prices, in bringing supply and demand into balance. When interest rates are low, it is more profitable to borrow money to invest in building houses or modernizing a factory or launching other economic ventures. On the other hand, low interest rates reduce the incentives to save. Higher interest rates lead more people to save more money, but lead fewer investors to borrow that money when borrowing is more expensive. As with supply and demand for products in general, imbalances between supply and demand for money lead to rises or falls in the price, in this case, the interest rate. As The Economist magazine put it, most of the time, mismatches between the desired levels of saving and investment are brought into line fairly easily through the interest rate mechanism. If people's desire to save exceeds their desire to invest, interest rates will fall so that the incentive to save goes down and the willingness to invest goes up. In an unchanging world, these mismatches between savings and investments would end, and investors would invest the same amount that savers were saving, with the result that interest rates would be stable because they would have no reason to change. But in the real world as it is, interest rate fluctuations, like price fluctuations in general, constantly redirect resources in different directions as technology, demand, and other factors change. Because interest rates are symptoms of an underlying reality and of the constraints inherent in that reality, laws or government policies that change interest rates have repercussions far beyond the purpose for which the interest rate has changed, with reverberations throughout the economy. For example, when the U.S. Federal Reserve System in the early 21st century lowered interest rates in order to try to sustain production and employment, in the face of signs that the growth of national output and employment might be slowing down, the repercussions included an increase in the prices of houses. Lower interest rates meant lower mortgage payments, and therefore enabled more people to be able to afford to buy houses. This in turn led fewer people to rent apartments, so that apartment rents fell because of reduced demand. Artificially low interest rates also provided fewer incentives for people to save. These were just some of many changes that spread throughout the economy, brought about by the Federal Reserve's changes in interest rates. More generally, this showed how intricately all parts of a market economy are tied together, so that changes in one part of the system are transmitted automatically to innumerable other parts of the system. Not everything that is called interest is in fact interest, however. When loans are made, for example, what is charged as interest includes not only the rate of return necessary to compensate for the time delay in receiving the money back, but also an additional amount to compensate for the risk that the loan will not be repaid, or repaid on time, or repaid in full. What is called interest also includes the costs of processing the loan. With small loans especially, these process costs can become a significant part of what is charged, because process costs do not vary as much as the amount of the loan varies. That is, lending $1,000 does not require 10 times as much paperwork as lending $100. In other words, process costs on small loans can be a larger share of what is loosely called interest. Many of the criticisms of small financial institutions that operate in low-income neighborhoods grow out of misconstruing various charges that are called interest but are not, in the strict sense in which economists use the term, for payments received for time delay in receiving repayment, and the risk that the repayment will not be made in full or on time, or perhaps at all. Short-term loans to low-income people are often called payday loans, since they are to be repaid on the borrower's next payday, or when a Social Security check or welfare check arrives, which may be only a matter of weeks or even days away. Such loans, according to the Wall Street Journal, are usually between $300 and $400. Obviously, such loans are more likely to be made to people whose incomes and assets are so low that they need a modest sum of money immediately for some exigency and simply do not have it. The media and politicians make much of the fact that the annual rate of interest, as they loosely use the term interest, on these loans is astronomical. The New York Times, for example, referred to an annualized interest rate of 312% on some such loans. But payday loans are not made for a year, so the annual rate of interest is irrelevant, except for creating a sensation in the media or in politics. As one owner of a payday loan business pointed out, discussing annual interest rates on payday loans is like saying salmon costs more than $15,000 a ton, or a hotel room rents for more than $36,000 a year, since most people never buy a ton of salmon or rent a hotel room for a year. Whatever the costs of processing payday loans, those costs, as well as the cost of risk, must be recovered from the interest charged, and the shorter the period of time involved, the higher the annual interest rate must be to cover those fixed costs. For a 2-week loan, payday lenders typically charge $15 in interest for every $100 lent. When laws restrict the annual interest rate to 36%, this means that the interest charged for a 2-week loan would be less than $1.50, an amount unlikely to cover even the cost of processing the loan, much less the risk involved. When Oregon passed a law capping the annual interest rate at 36%, 3/4 of the hundreds of payday lenders in the state closed down. Similar laws in other states have also shut down many payday lenders. So-called consumer advocates may celebrate such laws, but the low-income borrower who cannot get the $100 urgently needed may have to pay more than $15 in late fees on a credit card bill or pay in other consequences, such as having a car repossessed or having the electricity cut off, that the borrower obviously considered more detrimental than paying $15, or the transaction would not have been made in the first place. The lower the interest rate ceiling, the more reliable the borrowers would have to be in order to make it pay to lend to them. At a sufficiently low interest rate ceiling, it would pay to lend only to millionaires, and at a still lower interest rate ceiling, it would pay to lend only to billionaires. Since different ethnic groups have different incomes and different average credit scores, interest rate ceilings virtually guarantee that there will be disparities in the proportions of these groups who are approved for mortgage loans, credit cards, and other forms of lending. In the United States, for example, Asian Americans have higher average credit scores than Hispanic Americans or Black Americans, or White Americans for that matter. Yet people who favor interest rate ceilings are often shocked to discover that some racial or ethnic groups are turned down for mortgage loans more often than others, and attribute this to racial discrimination by the lenders. But since most American lenders are apt to be white, and they turn down whites at a much higher rate than they turn down Asian Americans, racial discrimination seems an unlikely explanation. Where there are lenders who specialize in large short-term loans to high-income people with expensive possessions to use as collateral, these collateral lenders, essentially pawn shops for the affluent or rich, charge interest rates that can exceed 200% on an annual basis. These interest rates are high for the same reasons that payday loans to low-income people are high. But because the high-income loans are secured by collateral that can be sold if the loan is not repaid, the high interest rates are not as high as with loans to low-income people without collateral. Moreover, because a collateral lender like PawnGo makes loans averaging between $10,000 to $15,000, the fixed process costs are a much smaller percentage of the loans, and so add correspondingly less to the interest rate charged.